The unsurpassed, penetrating, and imperfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Talk about meditation today. Since you've just been meditating, in the scripture of great wisdom, it says, you recite every day, it says, form, sensation, thought, activity, and consciousness are in their self nature void, unstained, and pure. And that isn't immediately understandable. But the Buddha's teaching in the Lakavatara Sutra is that we have to see everything as illusion, all these external forms that we deal with in our bodies, our minds. These are all an illusion. And our ability to see through that illusion is what we're why we meditate. We have this incredible tool that allows us to see things as they truly are. Most of the time we filter things through this concept of a self, and our likes and our dislikes and our greeds and angers and fears and all of that stuff. And the meditation is there to open us to something bigger, and to be able to know and experience that something bigger. Classically, the five hindrances to meditation practice are greed, anger, the restless mind, sloth and torpor, and worries, doubts, and fears. And I'll go through those a little bit more, one at a time. Greed, for example, if we meditate and we start thinking about something that we like to have, food, sex, entertainment, whatever it is that a mind wanders to and the habit of thinking comes up, that's where the greed then prevents us from actually just sitting still. The basic instruction in rules for meditation is just sitting with no deliberate thought. And this mind is the mind of stillness. And it enfolds everything. But our ability to focus on that stillness, can be prevented by our greeds or our angers, our fears. Our angers when we're criticizing either ourselves or somebody else in meditation, when we're upset about something. Ajahn Sumedho was talking about sitting in meditation, and his teacher would give talks in the local dialect for about 5 hours at a time, and he'd have to sit there cross-legged listening to them and he'd get really angry and in a lot of pain. Finally realized that he could actually do that without getting in a lot of pain, but he also learned the language. But what was most helpful was just to see how his anger prevented him from actually doing what was needed to do, which is to be able just to hear the Dharma, or just to be there with the Dharma, whether you heard it or understood it, it didn't matter. And how many hours have I spent in meditation being angry or upset about something? Or greedy or fearful, any of those things. The restless mind, what do you do with this restless mind that doesn't stop yakking? The thing to do is to be able to just hold it there. I'm going to talk a bit about the mind of silence in a little while, but all of these things that prevent us from actually meditating also have antidotes. So I'll talk to those in a minute. I think everybody knows about the restless mind. I don't have to go into any great detail about how the mind gets restless and babbles on. But this is a conditioned habit that we have to see that we have. This is where the self exists, is in this babbling mind. And our ability to see through that comes out of a very subtle change in our perception. The next obstruction is sloth or torpor, laziness and depression, not wanting to actually make the effort. And it does require a certain amount of effort. It doesn't just happen because we're nice people. It happens because we make an effort to learn to sit still. And that stillness is actually there all the time. We just have to tune into it. The last thing is the worries and doubts and fears. This is the lack of faith. There's actually nothing to be afraid of, but our fears are conditioned habits. And the more we act on them, the more we give them a reality that they don't actually have. But we have to see how those things get in our way. There are people here who aren't here today because they're afraid of the snowstorm, afraid they're going to catch a cold, they're afraid of other things. And these fears are the things that get in the way of our seeing things as they truly are. Because if we see things through a filter of fear, or a filter of greed, or a filter of anger, or restlessness, or whatever, we don't actually see the thing itself, we see it through our fears. And this illusion of self creates it's like a filter that keeps us from actually experiencing what the Buddha experienced. And the fears come out of a lack of faith. The faith in Buddhism isn't believing in some sort of doctrine or our ideas. It's a confidence in the practice, the willingness to do the meditation and also to keep the precepts and see what it is that we're doing to break the precepts so that we can change that. The willingness to actually look at ourselves honestly and see what it is that I can do to change is what allows us then to see things differently. And that seeing things differently is just a very subtle little shift in perception. But our greeds, people think we come from a society that's basically greed-oriented. You have to have something more. My brother had a friend who came over to measure my brother's swimming pool so he could make a bigger one for himself. And we have to have something more. And it has to be either more than our friends or more than our something or other. But it comes out of that whole sense of inadequacy that permeates Western culture, that there's something wrong with you just because you're born. And so you have to constantly be striving and for more stuff, more this, more that, whatever. So we've managed to store up that more stuff in our own minds. We have more thoughts that we need. And in Buddhism, what's the solution for greed is generosity, because you're enriched by what you give, not by what you have. What you have just becomes something you have to be responsible for dealing with. And what really enriches us is what we give. And in meditation, what we have to give is to give our attention, to give fully to what it is that we're doing at the time, being aware. That awareness is what really helps, because the awareness doesn't have a sense of self. And if in meditation you can be aware of what's going on in your mind, then you can see to apply the antidotes there. So if you're caught in greed, then give your attention to the stillness. Be generous with what it is that you're paying attention to, or the same with anger. The antidote for anger is all acceptance. And it's this radical acceptance of things as they are, rather than being angry about something that you don't like about somebody else or yourself or the situation or whatever. And this acceptance of things as they are allows you to let go of your dislike of them. And it just is as it is. And you can get upset about that if you want. You can get angry or you can do whatever, but the willingness just to accept it as it is what changes our relationship to it. Instead of something to be either greedy or angry about, it's, oh, well, it's okay. I don't have to fix it. I don't have to make it better. I just have to allow it to be. And the solution to the restless mind is learning to listen to silence. I'm going to go into this in some detail, but it's something that's really helped me in the last 10, 15 years to be able to just listen to silence. So silence has a palpable sense of sound, that you can actually hear that. If I want to tune into that, I can. A lot of times, and there are a lot of things that you can do in meditation, like watch your breathing or do a mantra or whatever, but ours is basically just sitting. And out of that just sitting, if you tune your mind into it, there is this underlying vibration that you can actually hear. And the willingness to listen to that is what is the solution to the restless mind. It's turning your attention towards that silence. Ajahn Sumedho has written a book called The Sound of Silence, and Ajahn Amaro just wrote a small thing that's available on the internet called Inward Listening. And the Sanskrit word for listening is nada. And nada in Spanish means nothing or emptiness. It's an interesting coincidence. In the early 70s, we were studying St. John on the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila. St. John used the word nada a lot in terms of understanding the spiritual emptiness. That is this understanding what it means by void, unstained, and pure. The spiritual emptiness is manifested in the silence. And the silence, Ajahn Amaro talks about the silence as a screen, like if your mind is like watching a movie, what holds that is the silence. And that silence pervades our minds. It's available to us in the midst of jackhammers and chainsaws and all sorts of other noises and distractions. And when we're focusing our mind on our food or our greeds or angers or fears or something, we don't listen to the silence because we're focusing our attention on something we want or like or dislike. And so what really helps there is just to focus on the stillness. It's, I call it the doorway to the infinite. It's the thing that opens up. Ajahn Amaro had an interesting discussion about how concentration can be a one-pointed thing, where like pointing your flashlight at one object, or it can be turning on the lights and seeing everything. And the silence works in both those ways. It can be focused on a one-pointed focusing on the silence, or it can be the silence that opens ourselves up to seeing everything. And this concentrating on the silence is what really helps focusing your mind, but it's not something that you can hold on to, because although it's there all the time, it also is changing all the time. And our ability to listen to that and focus our attention on that, instead of getting pulled off from all our habitual thinking patterns, is what allows us to truly meditate. But we have to keep focusing on this. The Sharangama Sutra is really all about understanding how to listen to that silence. Ananda was out accepting a meal from a donor who wanted him to come and receive this offering, and on his way back to the monastery, he was invited, the next day he was invited in to have a meal. It turned out to be a house of prostitution. And this young woman was chanting this chant that she was taught to be able to seduce young men. Ananda's name meant joy. He was a very good-looking man, and he was also very interested in women. He was the one who taught the Buddha into ordaining women into the Sangha. And so he was getting very interested. She was chanting this chant, and he was getting very interested. And the Buddha saw that this was going on, and he called the Bodhisattva Manjushri over to solve the problem. And he taught him the Sharangama litany and told it to go to where Ananda was with this young woman, and this would break the spell that she was chanting, and then bring them both back to the monastery. So by the time she gets back to the monastery, she's already become a bhikkhuni, and the Bhattava, by the time Ananda gets back to the monastery, he's very contrite and very ashamed of himself, and realized that he just about gotten himself into some serious trouble here. The Buddha was trying to explain to him about awareness, and he goes through several hundred pages about awareness. I'm not going to go through them all, but essentially what we're learning in meditation is how to be aware. How to be aware of our minds, how to be aware of our bodies. Awareness in every sense of the word, because that awareness is essentially what the Buddha is talking about. The awareness of things as they truly are. And after about 300 pages in the Sharangama, Ananda is still hoping the Buddha would just zap him with some sort of secret transmission so he doesn't have to do the work of training his mind. So the Buddha calls on 25 arhats and bodhisattvas to describe how they got their understanding. And after that, he asks the Bodhisattva Manjushri to decide which is the best for Ananda and the people of the Dharma ending age, which is us. And so Manjushri gives a very eloquent, about 25 pages of explanation on why what Avalokiteshvara described was what was best for everybody. So I'll read you what Avalokiteshvara described. Basically, it's the listening to silence. It's also going a bit deeper than that. So, I began with the practice based on the enlightened nature of hearing. First, I redirected my hearing inward in order to enter the current of the sages, which is another way of describing what the sound of silence is. Then external sounds disappeared. With the direction of my hearing reversed and with sound still, both sound and silence ceased to arise. So it was that, as I gradually progressed, that I heard, and my awareness of what I heard came to an end. Even when the state of mind in which everything had come to an end disappeared, I did not rest. My awareness and the objects of my awareness were empty. And when the process of emptying my awareness was wholly complete, then even that emptying and what had emptied vanished. Coming into being and ceasing to be themselves ceased to be. Then the ultimate stillness was revealed. All of a sudden, I transcend the worlds of ordinary humans, and I also transcended the worlds of beings who have transcended the ordinary worlds. Everything in the 10 directions was fully illuminated, and I gained 2 remarkable powers. First, my mind ascended to unite with the fundamental, wondrous, enlightened mind of the Buddhas in all 10 directions. And my power of compassion became the same as theirs. Second, my mind ascended to unite with all beings in the 6 destinies in all 10 directions, such that I felt their sorrows and their prayerful yearnings as my own. World-honored one, because I had made offerings to the Thus Come One who hears the cries of the world, I received from that Thus Come One a hidden transmission of a Vajra-like samadhi, such that my power of compassion became the same as the Buddha's. I was unable to go to all lands and appear in 32 forms that respond to what beings require. 32 means endless here. And what he's talking about here is learning to listen to the silence and sustaining that, and sustaining that, and sustaining that. And it doesn't matter how long it takes to sustain that. Just keep working on it. But understand the nature of the fact that infinite compassion is there within whatever suffering arises. They're not separate things. But the compassion and the suffering are there. That's why there's nothing to fear. Because no matter what it is that we're afraid of, if we're just there with it, it's okay. There was a story that Ajahn Brahm told of an old monk in Thailand who was out in the jungle giving a Dharma talk, and they kept hearing this rustling thing coming towards them. It turned out to be a rather huge cobra who came up to this teacher and hissed in his face. And the teacher just leaned over and said, "Oh, thank you for coming to my Dharma talk," and started petting this big cobra. And so the cobra went over to some other monk that wasn't quite so advanced in his training and hissed at him. And the guy was sitting there saying, "Oh, go away, go away, go away." But the cobra didn't do anybody any harm. And in fact, they haven't had any sort of recorded in history of any tigers in that jungle attacking monks with meditating, which is nice to know. Although there was an incident where in the life story of one of the monks, where these three monks were walking up and there was a big bull elephant standing in the path, and they had to get around this big elephant. And so the senior monks asked one of these other monks to go over and tell the elephant to move. And so he did, in a very friendly way. He said, "Big brother, we three monks have to get along this path. Could you move over?" And the elephant did. Just moved over and they walked by. But he said it in the nicest possible way. And we're not too often going to run into elephants or cobras, but we are going to run into the self. And that self appears in our mind all the time. And the solution to the restless mind is the focusing on listening to silence and bringing your mind to that awareness of that silence. But you also have to be first aware what it is you're doing with your mind. So if the mind is chattering away and you're not even aware that you're falling into these old habits, then you can't change that. But the more you become aware of that, the more then you can just focus on the stillness. And that willingness just to bring your mind back to being still is what this process is about. And then sustaining that, one of the underlying things of the Sharangama is developing patience with the mind of stillness. Or they've translated as the mind in which no mental object arises. So what I'm talking about with this sound of silence is in a way a mental object, although it's a mental object that doesn't have an object. And allowing yourself to rest in that awareness is what's important here. The next aversion in meditation is sloth and torpor, or laziness and depression and not wanting to make an effort. And you can't really meditate unless you're willing to make an effort. And this effort is not an effort of forcing or striving. It's an effort of willingness. But it's a vigorous effort. It's what's talked about in the exhortations to people who have recently died, is constantly over and over again being told to just be willing to accept this love of the eternal. And this willingness is what brings us to the meditation cushion to start with. So all of us have experienced that and know that on some level or another. But it's important to exercise it and to see where that willingness has a limit. Because where that willingness has a limit is where you have to work. That's where you have to apply this vigorous effort. Achalanatha, who sits over here in the corner of the meditation hall, has the mantra, "By our own wills and vigilance, may we our fetters cut away." It's by being aware of what it is that we're doing and seeing how it is that we create suffering for ourselves that we can actually change that. But if we can't see that, if we're not willing to do something about it, then hours on the cushion or whatever, just sleeping isn't going to help. You've got to be willing to look at what it is that you're doing in your life and see how it is, where it needs to be changed. Also, appreciate where it's doing okay. To see both the fact where you're making an effort and where you're acting out of a conditioned thing that there's something wrong with you just because you're there. And also being honest with ourselves about saying, well, I could have made a little better effort on that one. I could have done a little more preparation, or I could have done this a little bit differently in what I said to somebody or how I did things. And that willingness to look at ourselves and see where we can do better. Part of really doing the best we can is to see where we can do better. And if we can't see where we can do better, we're probably falling into a little bit of sloth there. Because we're not really looking very carefully at what it is we're doing. And seeing where our voice is too loud, or in my case, where my voice is too soft, and people can't hear what I'm saying, or where how it is that we address or don't address ourselves to people. That's part of the generosity, is giving yourself completely to the task that you're doing. And in meditation, it's giving yourself to that stillness. And when it's cooking, it's giving yourself to chopping the vegetables or turning on the gas and remembering to light it. Or doing things in a mindful way. And this is a training process. Ananda was not mindful of the situation he was in. He wasn't aware of what was going on in his mind. And so he was subject to being seduced. And what the Buddha was seeing was that Ananda needed to be woken up here, because Ananda had this phenomenal memory. We wouldn't have the Buddha's teachings without Ananda. He was able to memorize everything the Buddha said. But that was also his downfall, because he was caught up in his intellectual mind, and so he didn't want to train his spiritual mind. And it took him 20 years after the Buddha's death to actually have full understanding, because that intellectual mind, which is what we're educated into, to thinking that this is the mind that we need to deal with. We've been educated in a very intellectual way, and so learning to educate ourselves spiritually is a very important part of making spiritual progress. So learning to listen to that silence, learning to be generous, learning to radically accept the conditions as they are. It's just like, it's a pretty good radically accepting thing to not come to the meditation today if you're driving, because it really is a blizzard out there. And you have to accept sometimes that it's better not to go out on the road on days like that. On the other hand, it doesn't stop you from meditating. So you can meditate wherever you are, and you can listen to the silence wherever you are, no matter what the conditions are. And what you have to see is when you're not paying attention to the chopping of the vegetables, or when you're not paying attention to dealing with the thing, whatever it is that you're dealing with. And so it's a constant process of being aware of what the mind is doing at all times, and training the mind to have that edge of alertness so that you're paying attention to the things that you're dealing with. And this doesn't happen automatically. It happens because we train ourselves to do this. But this is where the real joy in meditation arises, out of this training process. Because when we train ourselves in generosity, when we train ourselves in acceptance, when we train ourselves in listening to the silence and awareness, when we train ourselves in vigor and willingness, that's when we have confidence in the practice. Because that confidence is it's not faith. You've grown up in a Judeo-Christian society, and you think you have to believe in certain doctrines. And that's not what this is about. It's confidence in not only doing the meditation practice, but applying that awareness to everything that you do. And seeing every time the mind does wander, every time you, can you do this in your sleep? I heard the cat go out at 2 o'clock this morning, because yesterday at 3 o'clock she brought in a squirrel that needed a funeral and a burial. So at 2 o'clock I heard her go out, and I woke up thinking, uh-oh, is she going to bring in another being? Fortunately, when she came in again at 3 o'clock, she didn't bring anybody with her. Generously left them all outside. And just got into bed and started to purr. So that was okay. And so I just meditated there with that. But the awareness is there even when you're sleeping, actually, is the point. That no matter what you're doing, you can train your mind to be aware of what's going on. And seeing where we're a bit lazy, or seeing where we're got caught up in greed or anger, or lost in our restless mind as it's traveling around the universe. But it's really important to that awareness, to realize that awareness is what we're training ourselves to do. And so whether it's going to the bathroom or working in the kitchen or shoveling snow or reading a book or whatever it is, give it your full attention. And this is not always easy to do. Learning to stay awake in a Dharma talk for 5 hours. I'm not going to go on for 5 hours today. Although there are times when I think I probably could, when I listen to this restless mind, it could go on forever. But what's important is listening to the Dharma, being aware of what it is that you're doing. And also see that those precepts are not just rules of moral behavior, but they are a spiritual explanation of how to act like a Buddha. And the reason why we commit ourselves to these precepts is not only to see what it is that how we behave, but also to see if we want to understand what the Buddha understood, we have to start behaving like a Buddha. And so our ability to see where we're keeping the precepts, our ability to see where we're stumbling over greed and anger and fear, and these other impediments in meditation, this is how we can learn to let go of the self. Because the self is the filter that keeps us from knowing the eternal. And Ajahn Sumedho's book on Don't Take Your Life Personally is a really good explanation of of how you get rid of the self. But it's nothing more than doing our meditation and keeping the precepts and realizing that we can use our awareness. Awareness itself is not the self. And in the Sharingan, that has this lovely line, that which understands the error is not itself in error. And it's shifting your attention to that understanding when you can see you're about to say the wrong thing or you've just said the wrong thing or whatever. That awareness of that then allows you to make corrections. I just read a book by a man who had a near-death experience, and one of those, he opens the book with a story of his interest in his dreams as a child about flying, and then his interest in being a parachuter and making formations in the air on their way down and things. And one time he was coming out, the last one of this group of 12 or something, and the person that came out before him opened his chute too soon. So the chute was coming at him at like several hundred miles an hour, and he had to get out of the way. And something just took over and helped him get out of the way. But that's essentially what we're learning in meditation, is how to get the self out of the way. And he had a very interesting experience when he was in a coma for 9 days, in a coma that had there was no medical cause that he could have this illness. It only happened under certain very rare circumstances, and these were not the circumstances. And but he was in this coma for 9 days and had this very intense experience. But he had no sense of self when he was in that experience, which is very interesting. And part of it was looking at what he called this earthworm view of things, like kind of being like underground. And then he looked up and he got taken to some really wonderful places. One of them he called this heavenly maiden that came and helped him. And he went into the core and he went into the void. And the void was just what the Buddha describes in the scripture of great wisdom. And it's this understanding that all of existence is in fact illusion. And the brain actually filters things through this illusion of self, and to keep us from realizing the vastness of things as they are. And that silence, if you meditate on that silence, that's the door into that infinite, if you use it that way. And the whole purpose of Buddhist training is to be of benefit to yourself and others. And this being of benefit has to do with seeing how greed and anger and fear are habits that we have created both from our past lives and from existing life. And we have the choice at all times to focus on those and add to them, or to focus on what needs to be done. This just subtle little shift, and it's like all the static that's created by not having your radio properly tuned, and when you do this little fine-tuning, then you get a really clear reception. And the same with our meditation, that all the static that we create in our own minds, all the suffering that we create, is done because of this illusion of self. And in the second chapter of the Shoshogi, it talks about the act of contrition and confession, so that we can acknowledge what it is we're doing and change. And it said, all the Buddhas and ancestors who have become enlightened have compassion upon us and free us from the obstacle of suffering that we have inherited from our past existence, and lead us in such a way that we may share in the merit that fills the universe. All the evil committed by me is caused by beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. All the evil is committed by body, speech, and mind. I now confess everything wholeheartedly. And that acknowledgement allows us then to receive the help from the Buddhas and the ancestors. and says, that's then is when you get the precepts. And Dogen has this lovely line, when these precepts are accepted wholeheartedly, then there's no subject or object for any who dwell within that, that understand. Because the having a self creates a subject and an object. There's a me and then there's the rest of the universe. And one of the things that this man experienced in his near-death experience was that consciousness doesn't exist in the brain, because his brain was completely unfunctional during this 9 days. And he realized that there is this consciousness that we all exist within, and he was able to get in touch with that and realize that there, within that, there is no subject or object. But he said it would be like if you had a sorrowful thought, it would be cloudy and rainy and everything. The external and the internal would be the same. Or if you had a joyful thought, it would be sunny and bright and whatever, you know, just the consciousness itself had no sense of self. It was just this universal understanding, and it had several things to teach, and one of them is that there is nothing to fear, and another is that what he calls love, we would call compassion and wisdom, permeates everything. And the experience of that is what allows us then to not only see things differently, but respond differently. And doing the training itself is what allows us actually to experience this. But we have to be open to that, have our awareness tuned to that consciousness that has no limits. And this is what we're learning in meditation, that there is a solution to the problems of suffering. And it's done through training the mind. It's done through the keeping of the precepts. It's done through seeing where we get the self in the way and willingness to change that. I think that's about all you're going to get today.